0632, July 30th, 2034, GMT plus 8, South China Sea. Weather had been erratic, thunderstorms appearing violently and then vanishing, wild fluctuations in temperature. Golf ball-sized hailstones fell on the deck of the Enterprise one morning. That same evening, the temperature peaked at 92 degrees. The onboard meteorologist surmised that this erratic weather was the result of the atmospheric fallout from Galveston and San Diego. They had struggled to find a launch window for Wedge and the 9 Death Rattlers. Each time they'd be given the all clear and migrate to their ready room for a final mission brief, a fresh weather system would appear. Complicating matters further was the fact that they didn't need passable weather, but perfect weather. The Hornets that Wedge and his crews would be flying didn't have GPS-guided bombs. Without that technology, they'd have to drop their ordnance in the old way, which meant they needed clear skies over the 3 target cities. After the 4th or 5th aborted launch attempt, Wedge had lost count. He found himself alone in his stateroom, sitting at his desk, trying to pass the time. 2 levels above him, he could hear the ground crews working. Each iteration of stand up, then stand down, cost them several hours. They couldn't allow 9 fully armed Hornets, particularly given the nature of their armament, to idle on a flight deck that was pitching through rough weather. Wedge took out his flight plan, reviewing it yet again. 9 aircraft launch, divided between 3 flights, blue, gold, red. Arrive at release point, 28 degrees, 22 minutes, 41 seconds north, 124 degrees, 58 minutes, 13 seconds east. Set course and speed to target. Xiamen, blue, Fuzhou, gold, Shanghai, red. For redundancy, each aircraft armed with nuclear payload. Only 1 aircraft per flight drops payload. Return. He knew that last bullet point, despite being the shortest, was the one with the least probability of success. He could feel it in his gut. But Wedge didn't do suicide missions. That's what he'd told Admiral Hunt, and he'd meant it. Instead of fixating on the slim probabilities of his return, he diverted his attention elsewhere. He began a letter. It wasn't an, "If you are reading this, then I am gone" death letter. He'd always held those in low esteem, thinking of them as little better than suicide notes. Instead, he thought of it as a historical document. He wanted to capture his thoughts on the eve of victory. He addressed the letter to his father. Wedge found himself writing in a sort of stream of consciousness, freed from the way he normally wrote, which was the composition of lists like the flight plan he'd just reviewed. It felt good to write in this way. A release. Although it was only him, alone in his stateroom, he wanted to bring all the world into this moment. The more he wrote, the more aware he became of his place in the universe. It was as though he could see his words being read by future generations of American schoolchildren before he'd even composed them. He could envision a child standing in front of the class, reciting portions of this note from memory, in much the same way Wedge himself had recited the Gettysburg Address. This wasn't his ego at work. He knew that he possessed no remarkable gifts of expression. A C- in freshman English could attest to that. Rather, Wedge knew it was the moment itself that was remarkable. A moment in which everything was on the line. Then he thought, "Christ, Wedge, get a grip." Except for a single page, he crumpled up the many sheets of paper and pitched them in his trash can. The remaining page sat on the desk in front of him. He didn't read it over. He didn't want to. What remained were his thoughts, as pure as he could harness them, to be handed to his father. Wedge found himself unexpectedly exhausted from the writing. He was soon asleep in his chair, his head on the desk. Time passed, perhaps an hour or more. There was a knock on his door. Wedge felt disoriented, as if maybe it had all been a dream. Perhaps he was back in his stateroom on the bush, before Bandar Abbas, before his stint in captivity, back to when he was still trying to get close to it. There was another knock. "What?" he growled. "Sir, it's time. Tell them that I'm coming." He could hear the sound of departing steps as he sat up. Wedge gathered his things on the way to the ready room. His notebook, his sunglasses, a pack of Marlboro Reds. He planned to smoke one on his triumphant return. He also thought to bring the letter. After all, it wasn't a death letter. There was no reason to leave it on his desk, was there? He glanced at it skeptically. Wedge eventually chose to leave the letter where it was. What did it matter? Whether for bad weather or maintenance issue, he'd likely be back in his stateroom in a few hours after yet another aborted launch. He could mail it then. Walking toward his briefing in the ready room, he took his time down the ship's passageways, even as every other member of the crew rushed past, as though in possession of some urgent piece of news. When Wedge came to an exterior hatch, he thought to take a minute to grab a breath of fresh air. What he saw caused him to hurry back inside the ship. The day was sunny, clear, and crisp. The most beautiful flying weather he could remember.
0642, July 30th, 2034. GMT-4. Washington, D.C. Hendrickson insisted Chaudhry catch the night flight. "Don't wait until morning," he said. "Get back here now." On the phone, Hendrickson confirmed everything Patel had said in the canteen. Wise Carver had rebuffed the Indian defense attaché when he'd come to the White House. The defense attaché had met with Hendrickson unofficially at a Starbucks to reiterate India's intention to take military action against either party, Chinese or American, who further escalated the crisis. Hendrickson and Chaudhry had this conversation over an unsecured landline between Washington and New Delhi. What did it matter if the Indians intercepted their call? They'd already intercepted their emails. Perhaps it would assuage them if they knew two national security staffers were taking matters into their own hands. Chaudhry's flight had been bumpy, with heavy turbulence over the Atlantic. When he landed at Dulles, Hendrickson was there to meet him. On the drive in from Northern Virginia, Hendrickson told Chaudhry the one thing he hadn't been able to mention over the phone. "All that's stopping the launch at this point is the weather." "The weather?" "The Enterprise is ready," Hendrickson said gravely. "The planes are fueled and armed. The pilots are briefed. After Galveston and San Diego, the weather's been erratic." "So how much time do we have?" asked Chaudhry. "Like I said, we've got until the weather gets better. After that, they launch." Chaudhry's flight had been virtually empty, which got him an upgrade to first class. Despite the upgrade, he hadn't slept a wink. Exhausted, he now leaned his head against the car window. His eyes grew heavy, and as they began to close, he noticed the traffic. It was early morning, DC rush hour. Except no one was on the road. He wondered when, if ever, they would return. The drive-in was quick, maybe 30 minutes, but Chaudhry felt he'd been asleep for much longer. They had no trouble finding a spot for the car across from Lafayette Park. In front of the office buildings, trash was piled up. Traffic lights flashed on mostly deserted streets. When they crossed the park, they walked past the peace vigil. The tent was empty, though at a glance Chaudhry couldn't tell whether or not it had been abandoned. The White House was, of course, in perfect order. The uniformed Secret Service agents stood at their posts. The morning's newspapers sat in reception, along with coffee and pastries. Chaudhry's surroundings began to reassume their familiar proportions. To his surprise, Chaudhry's badge still worked. A part of him had assumed that when Wise Carver dispatched him to New Delhi, it was with the expectation that he would never return. Soon, both Hendrickson and Chaudhry sat outside Wise Carver's office door. On the other side, they could hear the murmurs of a meeting in progress. Chaudhry and Hendrickson had no plan beyond confrontation. They would explain to Wise Carver that they knew about the defense attaché's visit. They would demand that he disclose this information to the president. The pilots on the Enterprise needed to know about the Indian threat. They had no idea that it wasn't the Chinese defenses alone that they'd have to contend with. If Wise Carver still refused to divulge this threat, Chaudhry and Hendrickson would go to the press, which, admittedly, wouldn't do much. The door to Wise Carver's office swung open. One by one, a group of staffers Chaudhry didn't recognize stepped into the corridor. They spoke in low tones, sharing sidebar conversations, even laughing here and there. In a word, these staffers, all hand-selected by Wise Carver, projected confidence. Last out of the room was Wise Carver himself. He stepped across the hall, his hand on the doorknob to the Oval Office. "Sir, do you have a minute?" asked Hendrickson. Wise Carver froze, his hand still on the knob. At the sound of Hendrickson's voice, he slowly turned over his shoulder. "No, Bunt, I don't have a minute." If there was any doubt in Chaudhry's mind as to how much of a nuisance Hendrickson had made of himself over the preceding weeks, it was now obvious. "Millions of lives are at stake," interjected Chaudhry. "To say nothing of an international radiation-induced pandemic and the collapse of the global economy, and you don't have a minute?" He was shaking, but managed to add, "You have an obligation to pass on what you know." Wise Carver released the doorknob. "Do I have an obligation to pass along misinformation?" He took a step closer to Chaudhry, invading his personal space. "Also," said Wise Carver as he ran his eyes intrusively over Chaudhry, "aren't you supposed to be back in New Delhi?" That word again. Back. Chaudhry didn't hesitate this time. He knew exactly what it meant. Had he come this far? Had his family endured so much, only to turn back? And back to what, exactly? He was here. Only a shut door separated him from the most powerful office on Earth. He was in possession of knowledge that could save this country. His country. If only he could convince Wise Carver to step away and let him pass to the other side. But there would be no convincing him. Of this, Chaudhry felt certain. That word, back, he conjured it into a necessary rage. If Wise Carver wouldn't step aside, Chaudhry would move through him. He reached for the doorknob. "Where do you think you're going?" snapped Wise Carver. Chaudhry shouldered into him. The two struggled, their arms hooking, their chests pushing against one another. Neither was a fighter, so the scene quickly turned sloppy, with both Wise Carver and Chaudhry losing their balance and taking an amateurish tumble to the floor. Hendrickson tried to separate them. Chaudhry lunged upward for the doorknob, as though it were the rung of a ladder placed just out of reach. Wise Carver swatted his arm down. The commotion didn't last long. Three Secret Service agents charged toward them, pulling both Chaudhry and Wise Carver to their feet. Wise Carver was left by the door. Chaudhry was escorted to the other side of the corridor.
"Get him out of here!"
shouted Wise Carver. Before the Secret Service agents could lead anyone away, the door opened. Chaudhry couldn't see inside, but he could hear her voice. That persistent and restrained voice of speeches. The voice that had, a long time ago, convinced him that staying in government was a good idea. It asked,
"What the hell is going on out there?"
0652, July 30th, 2034, GMT plus 430. Strait of Hormuz. The seconds passed with strange imprecision. Fershad stood steadily among his men, a panicked swarm of conscripts scrambling to their dugouts with boots untied and slung rifles jangling over bare shoulders. Fershad watched the incoming formations of planes, calculating their altitude and distance and factoring for wind. He would pass this along to the anti-aircraft gunners, who were already cranking at the elevation wheels that raised their barrels skyward, swiveling and locking themselves into position. Fershad then ran to his command post, nothing more than a hole with a radio dug into the rocky sand. As he crossed the beach, a half-dozen impacts struck behind him, blasting up fountains of earth. Then the shockwave. It brought him to his knees. Up again, he continued to run, calculating his steps. 20, 15. He was almost there. Another group of impacts, this time closer. Close enough that the shockwave blew the shirt up his back. Then he toppled over the lip of his command post, landing on his radio operator, who was gathered in a knees-to-chest bundle in the corner of the hole. "Get up," he growled. The young conscript slowly stood, a pleasing confirmation to Fershad that among his men he remained more frightening than death. A swift crosswind cleared the smoke from the last barrage. Fershad snatched the radio's handset. He called out range, altitude, and windage to his gun crews. His ability to triangulate the three being one of those refined soldier skills that proved useless elsewhere in life. All at once, his several anti-aircraft batteries began to chug out their fat, egg-shaped explosive rounds, the sky peppered with little detonations. Immediately, Fershad could tell they were off target. He had one battery of directed energy cannons, but when he looked at them, he could tell their generators weren't engaged. Another cyber attack? Or shitty maintenance? It didn't matter. Another missile barrage fell, this time directly onto his position. Fershad crumpled forward, hands on his head, eyes shut. He opened his mouth so his eardrums wouldn't rupture with the overpressure. And he waited, rolling the dice as he'd done so many times before. He could feel the alternating blasts, like a violent wind juking between two opposing directions. The back of his neck was covered in dirt. Then stillness. He lifted his head. Range, altitude, windage. Those were his first thoughts. He made his estimations and then gave another order to fire, noticing a slight tinge of desperation in his voice, which he swallowed away. This would be their last chance. The landing paratroopers would overwhelm the garrison if Fershad didn't take out at least a portion of their transport planes. Out chugged the egg-shaped explosive rounds. Again, the sky peppered with little detonations. Off target. All of them. Then Fershad realized what he'd done. The fatal mistake he'd made. He'd calculated for wind, but not for wind at altitude. The erratic weather had caused wild atmospheric fluctuations. The crosswind he was experiencing at sea level must not be blowing at several hundred feet, or it was at least blowing differently. Even though he now noticed the inconsistency, it was too late. Standing in his command post, Fershad could do nothing but look above as in quick succession thousands of parachutes blossomed open into tidy skyborne rows. The anti-aircraft guns continued to fire, though they proved ineffective against the dispersed paratroopers. Fershad placed his rifle on the lip of his trench. He glanced from position to the upturned faces of his men. A few took pot shots at the descending paratroopers, but most didn't, perhaps for fear of retribution. The seconds passed, as they had all morning, with strange imprecision. Time bent. A life's worth of consequences existed in the moments it took for a plane to pass overhead, or for a gust of wind to blow over a dusty fighting hole, or for a parachute to descend to earth, coming down at 600 feet, Fershad watched. 500 feet, he fingered his trigger. 400 feet, the radio clutched in his hand. 300 feet, the crosswind on his face. The swift crosswind. Fershad couldn't believe it at first, wouldn't allow himself to believe it. The crosswind he'd felt all morning caught the first stick of paratroopers as they descended below 200 feet. Their parachutes, snatched by the slipstream, now raced dramatically across the frontage of the island, yanked out to sea as if by invisible tethers. They splashed into the water. Within minutes, thousands of others fell on top of them, all into the water. Although a few paratroopers touched down on the beach or near enough to swim in, Farshad's conscripts quickly rounded them up. Soon Farshad was out of his hole, standing on its lip, observing the miraculous expanse of parachutes dispersed across the open water like so many lily pads coating a pond. Well into that afternoon, survivors crawled onto the beach, many retching seawater. The garrison rounded them up one at a time, trotting them off at rifle point with a jaunty confidence that Farshad's conscripts had hardly earned. Although this battle had cost the Russians an entire Spetsnaz division, Farshad didn't feel he could count the victory as his own. He and his opposing commander had, after all, made an identical mistake, albeit with different consequences. Both of them had incorrectly calculated the wind. There was an unfairness to it, thought Farshad, but also an irony. A miscalculation in one circumstance could win a battle, and in another, lose it. By the time the last of the paratroopers splashed into the water, the Russian missiles had stopped falling. Reports from Iranian reconnaissance aircraft scrambled from Bandar Abbas were that the Russian fleet, which was moving from the northern Indian Ocean to reinforce the islands after the paratroopers seized them, had retreated north, back toward the Red Sea and the Syrian port of Tartus. The Russian prisoners mixed calmly among their Iranian captors, the two sides swapping cigarettes, speaking each other's languages in broken phrases. Because neither nation existed in a formal state of war with the other, it allowed each side to assume a posture of mea culpa. The Russian paratroopers for their misbegotten and opportunistic invasion, and the Iranian conscripts for inflicting on them the inconvenience of captivity. Farshad's state of mind was neither apologetic nor hostile. He was numb. A bone-deep exhaustion had set in. After a battle, particularly a battle won, he had usually felt elation, a nearly uncontainable exuberance as he passed among his men, readying them for a counterattack and radioing his situation report to a congratulatory high command. Not this time. Farshad didn't have the energy to prepare his men for an unlikely counterattack. As for the high command, when General Bagheri's helicopter arrived from Bandar Abbas right after nightfall, Farshad could barely muster the effort to receive it. When Bagheri stepped off the ramp, he walked with his arm extended, as if the congratulatory handshake he offered to Farshad had lured his entire body from Tehran. "Fine work," Bagheri muttered. The radius of his congratulations spread wider as he trooped the line, clasping the shoulder of every soldier who came within reach. Only when a member of Bagheri's staff handed out challenge coins did the befuddled conscripts realize they'd met the chief of staff of the armed forces. General Bagheri and Farshad retired to the command post. They sat on the lip of Farshad's hole, staring out into the spongy darkness. "Did they land over there?" asked General Bagheri, pointing in a vague direction to where the night hid the thousands of parachutes littered over the surface of the water. Farshad nodded. General Bagheri gave a belly laugh. "You are the embodiment of Napoleon's most famous maxim. Do you recall it?" Farshad shook his head. Not because he didn't know the maxim, which he did, but because he didn't care. He could feel himself struggling to stay awake. General Bagheri prattled on. "When it comes to a general, Napoleon said, 'I would rather have one who is lucky than good.'" Farshad leaned his head all the way back, his face flush with the stars. He felt a slight spasm through his body, as one feels when dozing off in a dull movie. General Bagheri continued to speak, his voice and its message only partly registered to Fairshod, as he listed further and further toward sleep. Bagheera was stumbling through a half-hearted apology, in which he conceded that he hadn't believed Fairshod's report about the threat to these islands, but in which he also congratulated himself for possessing the intuition to send Fairshod to command the garrison. Fairshod propped his elbows on his knees and cradled his head in his palms. General Bagheera didn't seem to notice, continuing to heap praise not on Fairshod himself, but on his remarkable luck. The importance of this victory over the Russians couldn't be overstated, explained General Bagheera. It would unite the nation, and the nation would, of course, again recognize Fairshod with the Order of the Fat. School children would learn his name, which shouldn't be that of a lowly naval officer. No, this wouldn't do. General Bagheera then confided to Fairshod that his staff had already begun to process the required paperwork to have Fairshod reinstated to the Revolutionary Guards, and perhaps even promoted. This woke Fairshod up.
"You'll do no such thing."
"And why not?" asked General Bagheera, whose tone wasn't anger, but bewilderment. "Your country needs to honor you. You must let it. Is there some other distinction you would prefer? Say the word, and believe me, it will be yours." Fairshod could see that General Bagheera was telling the truth. This was Fairshod's moment to ask for what he truly wanted. And why shouldn't he? He'd given his country so much. Everything, in fact. From his father's assassination, to his mother's grief and death thereafter, to his own adult life spread across so many wars, everything he'd ever had or could have hoped to have had been laid on the same altar. "What is it?" General Bagheera repeated. "What is it that you want?"
"I think," said Fairshod sleepily, "that I just want to go home."
"Home? You can't go home. There's work to be done. Your reinstatement must be accepted. Then there's a new command to discuss. I have certain ideas." As General Bagheera spoke, the sound of his words receded, as if he were speaking at the distant end of a tunnel down which Fairshod had begun to travel. Fairshod had stopped trying to remain awake. He leaned onto his side in the dirt, tucked his knees to his chest, and with a rock for a pillow, drifted into the sweetest sleep he had ever known.
1857, July 30th, 2034. GMT plus 8. 28 degrees, 22 minutes, 41 seconds north. 124 degrees, 58 minutes, 13 seconds east. Blue Leader, this is Red Leader. Acknowledge arrival at release point.
Roger, Red Leader, this is Blue Leader. We've arrived.
Good copy, Blue Leader. Gold Leader, this is Red Leader. Acknowledge arrival at release point.
Roger, Red Leader, this is Gold Leader. Arrival acknowledged.
Good copy, Gold Leader. Red Leader confirms all flights in orbit at release point. Wedge checked his watch. They were right on time. According to plan, they'd hold at the release point for 5 additional minutes. This would be his last communications window with the Enterprise. After that, they'd go dark. Wedge then glanced below, to the vast expanse of ocean beneath his wing. The day was bright and clear, with perfect visibility. The conditions were ideal for him to see the column of smoke corkscrewing toward him from the water's surface.
0704, July 30th, 2034. GMT minus 4. Washington, D.C.
God help you if you're wrong.
That's all Wise Carver could say as Hendrickson was joined by Chaudhry in the Situation Room. The three of them sat at one end of the table while a single staffer dialed Indo-Paycom and the Enterprise for an emergency video teleconference. The president waited in the Oval Office while the White House operator scoured the switchboard for a direct line to the Indian Prime Minister.
0717, July 30th, 2034. GMT plus 8. Beijing. When Lin Bao arrived at the ministry, the lights in the conference room were out. Surprised, he switched them on one at a time and began to poke his head into the adjacent offices, trying to find his support staff, that platoon of junior officers who set up his video teleconferences, his live drone feeds, his numerous secure calls. They were nowhere to be found. Stillness pervaded the large, empty rooms. Not sure what to do, Lin Bao installed himself at the head of the table. With perfect timing, the phone next to him rang. He startled. He would have been embarrassed if someone had been there to see him. Then the thought occurred that perhaps he was being watched. Putting this thought from his mind, he picked up the phone. It was Zhao Leji.
No doubt you've heard the news.
The attack on the Zhenghe was part of the American response to Galveston and San Diego, replied Lin Bao. Sinking the Zhenghe demanded a reprisal. However, Lin Bao cautioned, it should be proportional. Perhaps they could use their surface-based missiles to strike at American interests in Japan or the Philippines. Such a response would be immediate. Also, there was always the opportunity to launch another cyber attack, perhaps this time against more critical U.S. infrastructure, like their electrical grid or water system. There are many options, Lin Bao explained. The key is that our response to the Americans be carefully considered. The line went silent. Hello? Said Lin Bao. A sigh. Then,
the Americans didn't do this.
Now it was Lin Bao's end of the line that went silent.
Zhao Leji added, it was the Indians who sunk the Zhenghe.
The Indians? Lin Bao's mind went blank. But why would the Indians? He struggled to find the right words. They've allied themselves with the Americans? Lin Bao had already begun placing one alliance against another as though canceling out the numerators and denominators in a complex equation whose solution would solve for how the American-Indian alliance might shift the global balance of power. This doesn't change anything with the Russians, nor the Iranians. With the Indians in play, we will, of course, need to keep the Pakistanis in check.
Lin Bao.
Zhao Leji cut him off.
India's involvement in the conflict is because of a strategic miscalculation. The sinking of the Zhenghe is a disastrous consequence of that miscalculation. The Politburo Standing Committee is meeting later today in a secure location. There's a man outside who will take you to us. We need you to help with our response. Do you understand?
Lin Bao said that he did.
Zhao Leji hung up.
Silence returned to the room. Then a knock. A man opened the door. He wore a dark suit and had a powerful build and a blank, anonymous affect. Lin Bao thought he recognized him from Mission Hills.
1916, July 30th, 2034, GMT plus 8, South China Sea. 37 minutes since launch. Sarah Hunt hadn't moved in that time. Fixed in the middle of the Combat Information Center, she stood with her arms folded across her chest, staring at a digital display that plotted an approximation of Wedge's progress from the Enterprise toward his mission's three targets. Behind her sat Quint, along with Hooper, the pair of them tuning their radios through a desert of static, searching for a return signal. "Are you sure you've got the right frequency?" Hunt asked Quint, trying to restrain her growing impatience. Quint, lost in his task, didn't reply. Beside the digital map was a video teleconference split between two screens. The first screen was Indo-PACOM, a conclave of admirals with furrowed brows calling in from Hawaii, none of whom had much to say. The second screen was the White House Situation Room, a smaller group that comprised Hendrickson, another staffer who Hunt didn't know but who introduced himself as Chaudhry, and in the background, Trent Wisecarver, who she recognized from television and who kept getting up to refill his cup of coffee.
"Are you sure he's arrived at the release point?" Hendrickson asked gently.
"Am I sure?" Hunt countered. "No, I'm not sure.
That's only where he's supposed to be.
Wedge was also supposed to have come up for a last comm check with the Enterprise, but they couldn't raise him. They were 37 minutes into the mission. At the 28-minute mark, Hunt had received the call from Hendrickson in which he had, with little explanation, ordered her to abort the strike. When Hunt had asked on whose authority, as she was obliged to do, Trent Wisecarver entered the video teleconference's frame and answered flatly,
"On the President's authority."
For the past 9 minutes, they had been trying to contact Wedge. They'd been met by nothing but static.
"Quint," snapped Hunt. "Are you sure they're on the right frequency?"
Quint glanced up at her very slowly, his unlit cigarette calmly dangling from his lip.
"Yes, ma'am,"
he said in a whisper, as if he were consoling her.
"I'm sure. He ain't there."
"He wouldn't miss a comm window. It makes no sense," she said.
Quint replied,
"What if it's exactly what it seems? Maybe he just ain't there. Maybe those Chinese or those Indians or whoever, maybe they took him and the whole mission out before they ever got to the release point. Ma'am, it might be they're all gone."
On the video teleconference, there was a sharp exhalation, almost like a laugh. It was Wisecarver. He was reclined in a chair, so only half of his body appeared on the screen. He leaned forward.
"Well," he said, "since we're trying to call off their mission, that would simplify things, wouldn't it?"
The only sound in response was radio static.
1858, July 30th, 2034. GMT plus 8. 28 degrees, 22 minutes, 41 seconds north. 124 degrees, 58 minutes, 13 seconds east. Wedge broke hard right, taking on altitude. The corkscrew of smoke climbed from the surface, chasing him skyward. "This is Red Leader. Missile launch, my 2 o'clock. He was banking hard as he could. 5G, 6G, then 7. He flexed his legs and abdomen, making little grunts as the G-forces sucked the blood downward in his body. He held there. Any more G and he'd black out. Little pinpricks of light burst in his vision like paparazzi cameras as his aircraft pirouetted almost as violently as the missile that he'd lost sight of. He popped chaff and flare from ports on his fuselage, the shards of burning magnesium tumbling in a celebratory arc to confuse the missile's sensors. Then a flash behind him, in the direction where the three Hornets that comprised Gold Flight had been assembled. He called out over the radio, trying to confirm what he already knew, which was that he'd lost one aircraft. There was no response. "Gold Leader, this is Red Leader," he repeated. And then he tried, any station, this is Red Leader, over." For a handful of seconds, he spoke into this emptiness until one of the other Hornets formed on his wing. The two held even like a pair of drivers idling at a traffic light. At a glance, Wedge couldn't tell which of his pilots this was. All he could see was the silhouette gesturing toward its ear, making the universal sign for, "I can't hear you." And another flash. Smoke enveloped his cockpit, debris collided with glass. As quickly as the smoke engulfed him, it released him. His aircraft was fine, again flying straight and level. Off his wing, the other Hornet had vanished, incinerated in that flash. He craned his neck forward and could see little flaming pieces of its fuselage drizzling over the ocean, on whose surface Wedge now observed a half dozen other smoking corkscrews, their white tails ribboning skyward. Then behind him in his mirror, Wedge glimpsed a section of four aircraft forming near his 6 o'clock. He could see their markings. A green, white, and orange roundel. Not Chinese. Indian. Wedge didn't quite understand. Since when were the Indians allied with the Chinese? Then two more flashes, one off his left wing and another off his right. An alliance between the Indians and Chinese didn't make any sense to Wedge, but he didn't have time to consider it. The shockwave from the two explosions came from separate directions, jarring his aircraft. His radio remained silent. He didn't know who he'd lost or understand who he'd lost them to. He still had a target to reach, and his only chance to reach it was to use these seconds of confusion to slip away, hug the contours of the Earth, and head north. His radio was surely being jammed, but he nevertheless called out to whatever remained of the Death Rattlers, ordering all ships to proceed to their targets. And as if in rebuttal to his words, he tracked another explosion high above him as a fifth Hornet was destroyed. Nose down, afterburners screaming, Wedge descended to below 100 feet, pulling up so low that his engines blew ripples across the ocean's surface. Above him, three of the Hornets remained tangled with a gathering number of Indian fighters, perhaps a dozen, which Wedge tracked as the superior SU-35. His Hornets didn't stand a chance. His pilot's skill would count for very little, maybe nothing. He knew that they understood this. Even though he couldn't communicate, he hoped they appreciated that the seconds they remained fighting in the air would be put to good use by him. With the Indians occupied, he'd make his escape, heading north toward Shanghai. Another explosion behind him, then a second, and eventually a third. Wedge had the head start he needed. If he stayed below 100 feet, with luck he'd slip the coastal defenses. Flight time was another 22 minutes. He checked his watch. It had been 43 minutes since their mission had launched. Even if his radio had worked, his communications window with the Enterprise had closed.
0714, July 30th, 2034. GMT-4. Washington, D.C. No one could get in touch with Major Mitchell. Admiral Hunt's decision to strip the Hornets of any overridable communication system had left the aircraft without any functioning communications at all. Without too much trouble, the Indians had jammed the low-tech UHF, VHF, HF receivers the aircraft relied on. From the White House Situation Room to the Combat Information Center on the Enterprise, the only sound was Quint as he continued to call out to the flight of 9 aircraft, his voice echoing across the video teleconference. In the Oval Office, a separate conversation was in process, the president requesting that her counterpart, the Indian Prime Minister, recall his fleet. The Prime Minister obfuscated. Was Madam President certain the aircraft that engaged her were Indian? The Prime Minister would, of course, need to confirm this with his Defense Minister and his Armed Forces Chief of Staff before recalling any of his assets. And what was the mission of these aircraft that had allegedly come under fire from the Indian fleet? Could Madam President kindly pass along the exact location of this flight of 9 planes? Nearly a dozen staffers, from CIA, NSA, the State Department, and Pentagon, listened on the line, furiously jotting down their notes on the Prime Minister's obvious stonewalling. This was also the word Wise Carver used when he stepped back into the Situation Room from the Oval Office. On hearing this, Chaudhry exited into the hallway and pulled out his phone. There was only one other thing he could think to do. But Dale answered on the first ring. "Quite a corner we've painted ourselves into," he said, without waiting for his nephew to speak. "You need to call off your aircraft," answered Chaudhry. He had cupped his hand over the receiver, concerned that he might be overheard. "Switch off your jammers so we can talk to our pilots."
"Pilot," corrected his uncle. "Our interceptors report that only one of them escaped. Two of our aircraft are giving chase."
"Recall your interceptors," pleaded Chaudhry. "Let us get in touch with our pilot to abort his mission." Even as he said this, Chaudhry wasn't certain it was possible. Would they be able to contact the pilot? Was he even listening? The line went silent. Chaudhry glanced up and noticed Wise Carver standing in the doorway of the Situation Room, watching him.
"Too risky," answered Patel. "If we call off our interceptors, how can we be certain that the pilot won't strike Shanghai?"
Chaudhry glanced once more at Wise Carver, who'd taken a menacing step in his direction.
"We'll abort the strike. You have my word. The president will..."
Wise Carver slapped the phone from his grip. In the time it had taken Chaudhry to utter his first sentence and then half of his second, Wise Carver had covered the distance between them.
"You don't speak for the president,"
Wise Carver snapped, planting the heel of his shoe on the phone so that when Chaudhry reached after it, he appeared as though he were groveling at Wise Carver's feet, which, in a way, he was.
"Please," said Chaudhry. "You've got to give us a chance to call it off."
"Not after Galveston," he answered, shaking his head. "Not after San Diego. Do you think this administration or this country will tolerate?"
For a moment he struggled for the appropriate word, and then found it, plucking it like fruit from a branch.
"Appeasement?"
Chaudhry remained on his knees, his hands still reaching pathetically for his phone as he glanced up at Wise Carver, who, with a halogen bulb from the ceiling framing his head, seemed to glow strangely, like a vengeful saint.
"There's only one pilot left," Chaudhry said weakly. "What are the chances he'll even make it to his target? If we call the Indians off, we could save him. We could stop all of this."
Wise Carver reached down toward his foot. He picked up Chaudhry's phone and tucked it into his own coat pocket. Then he offered Chaudhry a hand, hoisting him up from the floor.
"Come on," said Wise Carver. "On your feet. No need to stay down there."
The two stood next to one another in the empty corridor, sharing a quiet second as if to diffuse the tension between them. Then Wise Carver glanced up toward the lights that had framed his head a moment before.
"There's a quote from the Bible," he began. "Or maybe it's the Talmud or Quran. I can never remember which. But it's one I've always appreciated. It goes, 'Whosoever destroys one life has destroyed the world entire, and whosoever saves a single life is considered to have saved the whole world.' Or at least I think that's how it goes. Tell me, Sandy, are you a religious man?"
Sandeep shook his head. "No."
"Me neither,"
said Wise Carver. He walked off with Chaudhry's phone.
1919, July 30th, 2034. GMT plus 8. Shanghai. At first, the shore was just a smudge on the horizon. Then the contours of the skyline formed. At 1 mile out, Wedge would begin his ascent, climbing to his attack altitude. Everything would depend on altitude and time. He needed to take on at least 10,000 feet, so that when he activated and then dropped his payload, it would have sufficient time to arm. He needed to do this quickly, so that the anti-aircraft systems that lurked below couldn't find their mark. As he approached the city, his thought pattern was simple, almost primordial. "Here it comes. Here it comes. Here it comes," each breath seemed to say. At 5 miles out, he could see traffic on the roads. At 3 miles, he could see the waves breaking on the beach. At 2 miles, the individual windows in the skyscrapers winked at him as they caught the sun. Then he rocketed his stick, hard back. The G's pressed on his chest like an enormous hand. Pinpricks of light did their familiar Tinkerbell dance in his vision. Had anyone been listening, they would have heard his grunts, which were like a tennis player hitting from the baseline. A long stream of tracer fire arched toward him from the shore as he careened above Shanghai. Wedge rolled his plane belly skyward. With his cockpit hung toward the ground, he glimpsed two wispy missile launches whirling upward toward his head. He deployed the last of his chaff and flares, dumping the white-hot magnesium beneath him and hoping it would be enough to confuse the missiles. His altimeter orbited past 3,000 feet. Behind him, the pair of Indian Sukhois now appeared. He'd flown low enough and fast enough that they couldn't have tracked him. They must have figured he was heading here. His altimeter passed 4,000 feet. The Chinese systems didn't distinguish between him and the Indian pilots. All three of them corkscrewed and juked through the anti-aircraft fire that chewed up the sky, while their engines, with a dismal rumble, forced them ever higher. Wedge struggled to reach his drop altitude of 10,000 feet, while the Sukhois kept up the pressure, slotting into position on his tail. Any second they'd take their shot. Wedge knew he needed to deal with the Sukhois if he was ever going to get up to altitude. He barreled right. We'll decide it here, he thought, at 5,000 feet. Beneath the three aircraft, the city was lit up, spitting tracers in every direction. When Wedge had barreled right, the Sukhois had barreled left. The two sets of aircraft traveled in opposite directions along the circumference of a shared circle, whose miles-long diameter was nearly the size of Shanghai itself. Wedge couldn't help but admire the Indian pilots, who had made an astute tactical move. By giving up their position on his tail, they'd each be able to make a head-on pass, leveraging their 2-to-1 advantage. Wedge made his orbit around the city and prepared to meet the pilots somewhere along that path. They would come at each other like jousting horsemen of another era. Lances down, forward in their saddles. The issue decided in a blink. Events were playing out in seconds and in fractions of seconds. This is it, Wedge thought. The it he'd been chasing for the entirety of his life. He was ready. His thoughts returned to his family, to that lineage of pilots from whom he'd descended. He could feel his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather. Their presence so close, it was as if they were flying off his wing. A certainty possessed him. The advantage in numbers wasn't with the two assholes in the Sukhois, but with him, Wedge. Odds are 4-2, motherfuckers, he thought, and almost said it aloud. He locked onto the first Sukhoi, releasing a sidewinder from his wingtip, while simultaneously firing an exhalation's worth of rounds from his cannon. The Sukhoi did the exact same to him, so that their air-to-air missiles passed one another in mid-flight. However, the first Sukhoi had made a mistake. When Wedge diverted toward the second aircraft, so too had the sidewinder fired by the first. Wedge was out of chaff and flares to confuse the sidewinder, but if he could bring it in close enough to the second Sukhoi, that might disorient it. The second Sukhoi observed the threat of the incoming sidewinder. From its fuselage, it deployed chaff and flare. Wedge could see the sidewinder spiraling toward him as he rushed closer to the second Sukhoi, like a three-way game of chicken. Then the sidewinder dipped on its axis, following a burning piece of chaff. Simultaneously, both Wedge and the second Sukhoi released bursts from their cannon. When the two passed one another, there was a sound like a limb snapping off a tree. Blue sky everywhere. It turns to black, then rushes back to blue. The wind on Wedge's face. When he bolted awake, the stick had flopped out of his right hand. Wedge grabbed it, snatching back control of his Hornet. Checking his instruments, he hadn't lost much altitude. He couldn't have been unconscious for long, maybe a second, like an extended blink. A puddle was growing beneath his legs. He touched his right thigh and could feel a protrusion. A piece of steel, likely from the fuselage, had embedded below his hip. Two thumb-sized holes, around 30 millimeters, a little larger than his own cannon, had pierced the front left and back right of his cockpit, hence the wind on his face. He glanced behind him, to where the second Sukhoi would have passed. He found it easily, a brackish trail of smoke heaving from one of its engines. In the same direction, a little farther on, an oil-black smoke cloud lingered in the otherwise perfectly clear sky. This could only be one thing, the other Sukhoi. His sidewinder must have found its mark. He'd tallied his first-ever air-to-air victory. He felt dizzy, which might have been loss of blood, and might have been his body's response to the thrill of this achievement. Wedge now needed to climb to 10,000 feet. He still had his payload to deliver. Then he would figure out how to get home, or at least how to get far enough out to sea to bail out. Slowly, he climbed. His left rudder was shot out, making the plane skittish in its ascent and hard to control. Neither of his engines were at thrust capacity. The pair of them were bleeding fuel. Whatever damage he'd done to the second Sukhoi, it had done about the same to him. And as he climbed, that stubborn second pilot slotted in behind him, giving a limp chase. "Won't matter," concluded Wedge. He was already past 8,000 feet. He glanced down at the city spread before him. Little pits of light appeared in his vision. He tried to blink them away. Then a vertiginous darkness crept inward from his periphery, as though he might black out again. The puddle he sat in kept deepening. When he looked at his altimeter, it was blurry too, but it soon read 10,000 feet. Wedge went through the arming sequence. His hands felt as though he wore several sets of gloves as he clumsily toggled through the switches and buttons and lined up his aircraft into its angle of attack. The Sukhoi was behind him, but he had 30 seconds, maybe more, until he'd need to deal with that. A lot was going to happen in those seconds. Everything was set. Wedge's finger hovered over the button. Whatever wooziness or confusion he'd felt moments before had yielded to a perfect clarity. He hit the release. Nothing. He hit it again. And again. Still nothing. And now the Sukhoi was coming up to altitude, notching in behind him. Wedge struck the controls in his cockpit in frustration. He recalled the 10th Hornet in their squadron, the one that had gone down in training days before. He thought they'd fixed this problem with the release mechanism. Apparently not. Didn't matter. He had a job to do. Wedge pushed the stick forward, angling into a dive. The payload was going through its arming sequence, and if it was stuck on his wing, he'd take it in himself. The Sukhoi didn't follow, but instead broke away, understanding the maneuver and evidently wanting no part of it. Not that it would have made a difference. The Sukhoi wouldn't be able to put enough distance between itself and what was to come. A sensation of weightlessness overtook Wedge as he dove. The details below. Buildings. Cars. Individual trees. And even individuals were filling in fast. This business. War. The business of his family. And of his country. He'd always accepted that it was a dirty business. He thought of his father and his grandfather. The only family he had. Hearing the news of what he'd done. He thought of his great-grandfather, who'd flown with Pappy Boyington. And strangely, he thought of Pappy and the old stories of him staring out through his canopy, scanning the horizon for Japanese fighters, a cigarette dangling from his lip before he'd toss it into the vastness of the Pacific. The city was rushing up toward Wedge. He'd told Admiral Hunt that he didn't do suicide missions. Yet this didn't feel like a suicide. It felt necessary, like an act of creative destruction. He felt like he was the end of something, and in being the end, he would achieve a beginning. Wind from the broken canopy was on his face. At 500 feet, he remembered the pack of celebratory Marlboros he'd tucked into his flight suit, in the left chest pocket. Though it was futile, he reached for them. This was his last gesture, his hand placed over his heart.
1919, July 30th, 2034, GMT plus 8, Beijing. Three more men from internal security waited in the lobby of the Four Seasons Hotel. They stepped onto the elevator with Lin Bao. Not a single introduction, no one speaking. His escort, the dark-suited man who'd taken him from the ministry, had the number of the suite where Zhao Leji and other key members of the Politburo were clandestinely meeting to discuss the appropriate strategic response to the sinking of the Zhenghe. Lin Bao had ideas as to what that response could be. He chose to focus on those ideas, as opposed to why they were meeting at the Four Seasons and not some more secure location, or why they'd stepped out of the elevator on only the fifth floor and were now walking down a corridor with closely spaced rooms, as opposed to suites. India's involvement might prove a positive development, if leveraged correctly. An Indian intervention would make it so that the strikes against Galveston and San Diego would be the last of the war. If his country struck the final blow, they could make the argument, at least to their own people, that they had been the victors. And they could avoid what at this moment seemed like an inevitable counterstrike against another of their major cities. Tianjin, Beijing, or even Shanghai. He would explain this to Zhao Leji and to whoever else from the Politburo attended this meeting. Lin Bao imagined that Zhao Leji would place some of the blame for the Zhenghe on his shoulders. After all, it had been his name on the deployment orders, not Zhao Leji's or that of any other member of the Politburo. They would likely accuse him of having exceeded his authority in a time of war, but nothing more than that. They would want to be rid of him. After peace was negotiated with the Americans, it would be easy for Lin Bao to convince Zhao Leji to turn the other way while he defected. If anything, a defection would help prove the substance behind the accusations Zhao Leji would surely level, which was that Lin Bao was untrustworthy, a secret ally of the Americans. Good riddance, they'd say. And he would return to the country of his mother's birth, maybe even to Newport with his family, to teach. By the time Lin Bao had walked to the far end of the corridor on the fifth floor, these ideas had calmed him, so that when the security man swiped the key card and gestured with a low wave of his hand for Lin Bao to step inside, he did so without any trace of fear. He took a half dozen steps into the empty room. It wasn't a suite. It was a single. There was a queen-size bed, a console, a dresser. Everything, including the carpeted floor, was covered with plastic tarps, as though the room were undergoing a renovation. Lin Bao stepped toward the bed. Resting on its edge was a golf club, a 2-iron. He lifted it up. The familiar weight was pleasant in his hands. A note was attached to the shaft with a piece of string. He took a deep breath, filling his lungs, knowing it was likely the last such breath he might take. The writing on the card was blocky, the symbols formed by an untutored hand, the hand of a peasant. It read, "This time, you picked wrong. I am sorry." It was unsigned. That's how they survive, he thought. They never sign their names to anything. From behind Lin Bao, a series of steps squished over the plastic. He could feel the presence of the large security man at his back, plus the three others who no doubt stood by the door, waiting to help clean up the mess. Lin Bao had an instinct to shut his eyes, but he fought it off. He'd watch until the very end, in this grim room where there was little worth seeing. He peered out the solitary window to the equally grim Beijing skyline. The idea that this, not his daughter's face, nor the open ocean he loved, would be the last thing he ever saw, filled him with self-pity and regret. He felt his throat constrict with those emotions in the same moment he felt the cold press of metal against the soft hairs at the base of his neck. "Keep your eyes open," he demanded of himself. He continued to stare out the window, which faced to the southeast, generally in the direction of sunrise and the Pacific. Though it was late, a brilliant light like 20 sunrises all at once kept expanding unrestrained from that direction, as though the light itself had the potential to consume everything. This was coupled by an incredible noise that shook the windows and assured that no one heard the single gunshot. "What is that on the horizon?" Lin Bao wondered. It was his last thought as he toppled forward onto the bed.